Windy, mild, a high of 76. Cool northeast winds 10 to 20 miles per hour. And once again, you're advised to stay out of Lake Michigan today through Sunday because of dangerous waves and currents. Right now, wind northeast at 12, 68 degrees for both Kenosha and Racine. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Friday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're going to be talking for the next few minutes about something that many of us fear is largely winking out of existence, bipartisanship and bipartisan cooperation. In fact, it is not entirely extinct, but I think most observers would agree that we do not see bipartisanship and bipartisan cooperation to the extent that we once did. A book has just been published that explores the importance of bipartisan cooperation for the sake of the well-being of our American democracy. That book is called Across the Aisle: Why Bipartisanship Works for America. It is edited by Jill Long Thompson, a former congresswoman from Indiana, who is also the author of The Character of American Democracy, Preserving Our Past, Protecting Our Future. She also was a visiting clinical associate professor of ethics at the Kelly School of Business and the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University in Bloomington. By the way, this book is published by Indiana University Press, and many of the voices we hear from today happen to be from the state of Indiana, although by no means are those the only voices that we hear. And there is an impressive array of essayists whose thoughts are collected here, and they come from both sides of the political aisle. And there is much that is compelling about this book, in this book, about bipartisanship and its importance. The title of the book, again, Across the Aisle: Why Bipartisanship Works for America. And Jill Long Thompson, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you. It is a privilege and a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So tell us what prompted you to, I want to ask you about what prompted you to put this book together. But first, I think it would be interesting to find out a little bit about you personally in terms of where you are from originally, if you hail originally from the state of Indiana, and what was your pathway into public service and particularly into the political arena.
I grew up on a grain and dairy family farm on a dirt road in northern Indiana. And at a very early age, my dad was a precinct committeeman, and my mother was a volunteer with the Democratic Party. And when I would come home from school in the first grade, my mother gave me a choice. I could either help my dad milk the cows, or I could go with her to register new voters in the precinct. And I chose to go with her to register new voters in the precinct. I didn't think that was a difficult decision. But I was not anticipating. I'm pre-Title IX, so I had a fairly narrow view of career options in my head. And I was a graduate student at Indiana University in the late 1970s, working on an MBA and then a PhD at the School of Business at IU. And I would listen to politicians talk about the macroeconomy as we were experiencing a recession and double-digit inflation, and I realized that they didn't know as much about the economy as I did, which was a surprise to me. And I decided that maybe I should use the knowledge that I was gaining from my education, both undergraduate and graduate, education to make a meaningful contribution to the country. And that's when I decided that I would become much more politically engaged than I had originally intended to.
Mm. I love that. Tell us a little bit about what prompted you to want to put together this book about bipartisanship.
I, as you mentioned, I had written the book, The Character of American Democracy, Preserving Our Past, Protecting Our Future. And that was also published by Indiana University Press. And the director of IU Press asked me if I would be interested in putting together a book of essays on bipartisanship. And I thought that there was a need for such a book to exist. And so I agreed to do so. And I really did enjoy working on this book because it provided an opportunity to work with many people for whom I have a great deal of respect, both Democrats and Republicans. For example, former Senator Trent Lott and former Senator Tom Daschle, Richard Painter, one of our sitting senators in Indiana, Senator Todd Young, as well as Congressman Andre Carson, but also the longest-serving woman in the House, Congresswoman Marcy Kaptur, former Senator Olympia Snowe. It really was during this time of so much rancor in the democratic process in the country, I really did enjoy this opportunity. And I think it's very, very important that we give much more thought to what it means to live in a democracy, how to be responsible citizens in a democracy, and how to lead in a democracy.
I know you, I think, touched on this in giving, you know, some background on where you come from and so on, but I think it would be really fun to hear more about that experience you had at the tender age of six in terms of first learning about the importance of working together in order for our democracy to function at its best. I just think the thought of someone that young seeing that and understanding that is really remarkable.
My mother was just a very respectful person, and she had an incredibly engaging personality. And the homes that we went to were the homes of people who were not registered to vote, and some were new residents in the precinct. Some had been there for a while but just had not registered. And I still remember her saying, after she introduced herself, and she would tell them that she had her daughter with her, and she would ask them if they were registered to make sure that because they could have become registered and it hadn't been recorded when she was putting her lists together. And then she would ask them their party affiliation. And if they were Democrats, she would, of course, register them because she was a volunteer with the Democratic Party. But if they were Republicans, she would say, now I'm volunteering on behalf of the Democrats, but I want to make sure that you know how to get registered to vote. She said, I'm just registering Democrats. And she would give them the information, and she would answer any questions that they had, and she would be very polite and respectful and talk about the importance of participating regardless of your party affiliation. And I was just very, very struck by how people would take a liking to my mother and that they trusted her and that she was just so respectful of everyone that we would meet in that process.
Hmm. That's so good, and it's so basic. And it's, in some ways, it's the kind of thing that should go without saying. It should just be the way we carry on such duties and responsibilities. I mean, it, in some ways, it shouldn't even be worth, you know, drawing attention to, except, of course, it feels increasingly rare in our modern political arena for people to be functioning with that kind of openness and spirit of camaraderie and cooperation. I mean, it is so lovely, and it also kind of makes us sad to think that this seems to be something receding from public life.
Well, I think many people have lost sight of what it means to live in a democracy and forget that democracy is actually a very ethical concept that requires an ethical process to survive. And I always like to refer to a definition of democracy that was developed by the late J. Roland Penick, a very renowned political scientist. And I'm going to quote this for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Government by the people, where liberty, equality, and fraternity are secured to the greatest possible degree, and in which human capacities are developed to the utmost by means including free and full discussion of common problems and interests. And that's the end of that definition. But in democracy, the process by which we adopt, execute, and enforce our laws is as important as the laws that we adopt.
Hmm. And we sometimes lose sight of that.
Yes, we do. And it's not about me getting my way or you getting your way. It's about us working together to move our communities and our country and our world forward. But not only is the process important because of the values of democracy, research shows that we get better decisions when we incorporate the input of people who have a diversity of experiences and who are diverse racially, diverse in gender, diverse in backgrounds. It's just so important that we incorporate the input of everyone because we make better decisions. McKinsey, for example, has research that shows that corporations that have diversity of leadership in their top management financially outperform other companies. And we know that the old saying, great minds think alike, actually, great minds don't all think alike.
Right. That's one of my favorite moments in the afterword of the book, which you say. And of course, that assumption, I mean, it's sort of an elegant turn of phrase, great minds think alike. I mean, if only that were true, but in fact, as you tell us, it's not. In fact, you know, you say research findings tell us that great minds do not all think alike, and we need to understand that. And it's interesting, just by thinking about that, we realize that kind of opens the door to this whole notion of bipartisanship, because if there can be a great mind that sees the world a bit differently than I do, there should be room for both of us. And that other person with a great mind has something to offer me, and vice versa. And there you go. That's part of what this is all about.
Absolutely. And I can recall, in addition to having that experience going door to door with my mother to register voters, I can recall my dad many times when I would come home from school and I would tell him something, he would say, "Now, Jill, there's another side to that story, and you need to have more information before you get upset about something, before you think you have all the answers. There's more complexity to that matter than you might realize." And we all need to remind ourselves of that all the time, because we don't have all the answers. And when we talk to people who have different experiences and different knowledge than we do, we learn something.
We're speaking with Jill Long Thompson, who has edited a new book called Across the Aisle, Why Bipartisanship Works for America. There are a lot of interesting thoughts about bipartisanship that are offered in the book, and I want to begin with a couple of thoughts that we see in the introduction, which was co-written by Trent Lott and Tom Daschle, one a Republican, one a Democrat, with well more than half a century of U.S. congressional experience between them. One of the things I appreciated in what they talk about is, you know, speaking of misnomers, this picture of America as a melting pot. They say in their introduction that in describing the U.S., melting pot is a misnomer because Americans have never really melted together. Our country is more like borscht. I wonder if you could just say a word about this observation that they are making and to whatever extent you agree with it.
Well, I completely agree with that. And as much as I had studied as a doctoral student and a professor, I learned a great deal as a member of the U.S. House. I learned a great deal from constituents across the district, as well as fellow members in the U.S. House, as well as many other people that I had the privilege and opportunity to meet and work with. We don't all become alike, but if we do get to know one another, we broaden our perspective and we make better decisions. And we don't want to all become alike, because if we do, we won't make decisions that are as good.
Exactly. Something else that they make mention of that actually comes up in one or two other essays is the whole matter of lawmakers once upon a time spending much more of their time in Washington. But now, because of various things that allow people to fly back and forth and work remotely and so on, there just apparently isn't the need for lawmakers to be actually physically present in Washington to the same extent that they once were. And Mr. Lott and Mr. Daschle see that as a significant factor in why we see a bit less bipartisanship than we once did. I would love to hear your thoughts on that.
Well, I completely agree with that. And I think that that is reflective of something that is actually happening outside of Washington, D.C. as well. As people have become increasingly mobile, they tend to settle into communities of others who are similar, who have similar income levels, similar education levels, sometimes similar backgrounds. And that's very different from the kinds of communities that I can recall from my childhood, where you might have a big house next to a small house on the same street. In the school, the public school that you went to, you had children from various income levels. Our parents all knew each other. I recall none of my grandparents went further than the eighth grade. And our family doctor was a farmer as well as a doctor, and he was very respectful of my grandparents and what they knew about farming and would ask them about different farming matters, different production agriculture issues. And I really believe that while mobility is not a bad thing, it is a good thing, that we need to recognize the value of spending time with, getting to know, and working with people who are different from ourselves. And that sometimes isn't as comfortable as we might want it to be, but in the long run, it's better for us and better for our communities and better for our country.
At one point, actually, in the first chapter of the book, John Harwood, who is a Washington correspondent, talks about personal relationships that oil the gears of government, which I really, really love. And in the course of talking about that, he quotes a former Republican representative from Louisiana, Jim McCrary, saying, "When you get to know somebody as a neighbor or your kids are on the same soccer team, it's harder for you to go on the floor and call them names." I thought that was just such a, you know, that's talk about getting back to basics. But really, that seems like kind of the heart and soul of what we are talking about, and would seem to be one very good explanation about why we have drifted so far from something that once upon a time was a standard and familiar feature of American political life.
I completely agree with that. And we find that in our day-to-day living as well as in politics, that when we truly get to know people, we like them and we care about them. We may not always agree with them. We may not always approve of what they do, but we develop an understanding of what's motivating them. And we also recognize the challenges that they're facing. You really don't know when you are walking down the aisle with your cart getting groceries at the grocery store and you see other people, you don't know what they're going through. You don't know how difficult their life is. But if you get to checkout and they look like they're a little stressed and you offer them to get in line ahead of you, and you can tell that it makes their day when they do, you start to realize that we're neighbors and we're all in this together, and I have 10 minutes to spare and they don't. And you understand why they, you don't know the reason, but you understand why they look like they might be having a difficult day.
Right. And of course, it's interesting that Mr. McCrary was talking very specifically about was the phenomenon in Washington, where if these politicians are not really living in Washington the way they once did, then they are having fewer of those kind of encounters where their kids play on the same soccer team and so on. Of course, out in the rest of the country, one would hope that that can be an avenue for greater understanding and cooperation when, you know, when you're in Minot, North Dakota, or Baton Rouge, Louisiana, or Carson City, Nevada, or wherever you happen to be. But, of course, that brings up another point made repeatedly in your book, that in a country in which we seem to want to sort ourselves more and more by what we believe, by how we see the world, as the red states get redder, as the blue states get bluer, those kind of just real-life encounters with people from across the aisle become a little less common.
They do, and then you throw in the issue of gerrymandering and having congressional districts that are much more extreme. We don't have as many swing congressional districts as we used to have because we have technology that makes it easy to see the numbers precinct by precinct, and it's not only easy to see them, it's faster, but we find ourselves using technology and not just professionally but in our personal lives in ways that really aren't making us stronger as a family or as a community or as a country, but everyone is so busy and so disrupted, if you will, by text messages and email messages, and while the technology is a good thing, we need to make sure that we're using it in a good way for our families, our communities, and our country.
In some ways, towards this end, this is taking a little longer historical view, but something else that is mentioned in the first chapter of the book by Mr. Howard talks about certain periods in our nation's history when we seemed as Americans to be particularly prone to bipartisanship, maybe more open to the opportunity, more receptive to it, and more engaged in it. And he sees the years during and after World War II as being a particularly positive period in terms of bipartisanship. And he writes at one point, "The service and sacrifice World War II required cut across every segment of society, rich and poor, black and white, immigrant and native-born. It provided a core layer of mutual understanding that later generations would struggle to grasp." I mean, I suppose it's possible to overstate it, but it seems to me that he is touching on something really quite profound. And it seems like that is one explanation for why, although those post-World War II years were far from ideal, far from perfect, there was quite an extraordinary extent of cooperation that existed and which allowed some extraordinary things to happen.
John Harwood is so insightful and analytical, and I think that by including that in his essay, that it provides an opportunity for those who read it to communicate with others in ways different from how we're doing things right now in this country. I think that when we recognize that we're all in this together, and I may not see things as you see them, you may not see them as I see them, and we have neighbors that don't see them as we see them, but we're all in this together, and how do we work together to get along, to share our ideas, and to make our communities stronger, and frankly, on a very basic level, to be responsible citizens and voters of this country. And I know that families are stretched so thin, and as you know, the Surgeon General of our country has begun to address that issue because it is serious. At the same time, we cannot lose sight of the responsibilities that we have as members of a democratic society, and to keep it strong and to make it even stronger and just to ensure its survival. We have to reach out to people with whom we disagree and respect their right to disagree with us and recognize that maybe they know something we don't know.
Hmm. For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Jill Long Thompson, a former congresswoman from the state of Indiana. She is the editor of a newly published book called Across the Aisle, Why Bipartisanship Works for America. She has gathered together some really, really interesting examples of some interesting essays on the issue of bipartisanship, how it has played out in American history, and the ways in which it has suffered decline, of course, currently in our current political landscape. And there are also thoughts offered on some ways back towards greater bipartisan cooperation. I don't remember who said it, but actually it is said repeatedly that our country was born out of some very bitter political divides. And so in a sense, it shouldn't be a huge surprise that there is as much contentiousness as there is. In fact, I think it's Mr. Harwood in chapter one who says, government in a democracy is inescapably contentious. I think most of us would absolutely agree with that. So what is the line that gets crossed? I mean, maybe another way to ask it is, how much contentiousness and disagreement is okay? At what point, in your view, does it become something that is profoundly counterproductive and even destructive?
Well, I think that when we decide we're going to fight instead of work together, I think, and it is very important to stand up for the underlying principles of democracy and to work to defend and protect our Constitution and our constitutional rights and our constitutional values. At the same time, there are different ways of approaching how we resolve our differences. And it's not unlike being a member of a family. We don't always agree with every member of our family. In fact, on any given day, we probably have a disagreement with at least one person in our family. And we can approach those disagreements by fighting, or we can approach those disagreements by sitting down and talking and not being so concerned about winning as about working together to find a solution. As members of a democracy, our goal should be to work together to find solutions, not to fight with one another.
In the preface of the book, a former U.S. Representative, Marcy Kaptur, that you mentioned.
Oh, she's currently a member.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry.
Yes.
Right, I misspoke. My apologies.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
From Toledo.
She says at one point in her preface to your book, bipartisanship is tedious hard work. I really appreciate the fact that those words are in this book and that they appear so early, because I think it sort of disengages us from the notion that bipartisanship has a beautiful, easy, lovely sort of flow to it. And if we just let go of our own whatever, then we just, you know, become fast friends with one another and everything is great. And I just love that dose of real life that is introduced very, very early on, that to achieve bipartisanship is not easy, and it's probably not even pleasant, especially in the actual process of achieving it. Can you just talk a bit about that, about, in a sense, what achieving bipartisanship looks like and feels like, especially where when you're right in the middle of it? And I know about that, you can speak from experience.
Well, I had the privilege of serving on the House Agriculture Committee. And when we had disagreements, they tended not to be partisan disagreements, but they would be disagreements based upon the kinds of commodities, the kinds of production agriculture that was prevalent in our respective congressional districts. So if you were from the Midwest, you were, of course, I had a very good understanding of corn production or soybean production, for example. If you were from the South, it would be cotton, sugar, and so on and so forth. And so we were not as partisan as some congressional committees. At the same time, it's not easy to find the solutions when you don't have all the knowledge that you need to make good decisions, and when you feel very strongly about protecting the interests of a particular group of citizens in your home state or your home congressional district. And just like you run into these issues in your families, you have to put the pride aside, if you will, and genuinely roll up your sleeves and look for common solutions and think about it as we need to get along. We can't be a strong country if we're all fighting one another, in the same way that you can't be a strong family if you're fighting one another. And I think attitude is just so important to making a democracy work. And I have to tell you, I had as many Republican friends as Democratic friends serving in the United States House of Representatives. And when I was undersecretary at the Department of Agriculture, and when I served as the board chair and CEO of the Farm Credit Administration, I would seek input from both Democrats and Republicans and make better decisions as a result of it. And I think a lot of it is we all need to work to develop what I call the democratic attitude. We work together and find common solutions. And I also think that with social media and the erosion of independent news sources, that we have to work even harder today than we did 10 years ago. And yet we all have that responsibility, and we need to not just watch one news channel, unless it's public media, of course, but we need to know what everybody is saying, and we need to be the adult in the room, if you will, the kind adult in the room who's very committed and willing to work with everybody regardless of what their intentions are.
We're speaking with Jill Long Thompson about her new book, Across the Aisle, Why Bipartisanship Works for America. Marjorie Hershey, in her chapter, she is a professor of political science at Indiana University, says that bipartisanship is especially crucial to U.S. politics because the American version of democracy is unique. Unlike most other democracies, such as that in the United Kingdom, which are majoritarian. This was a distinction that I had not really stopped to ever think about. Can you just talk for a moment about what she is getting at, the very nature of our type of democracy and why bipartisanship is all but essential for that kind of democracy really operating optimally and in the healthiest fashion.
We share the leadership and the responsibility differently in the United States, in that you don't just automatically, because you're a Democrat and there's a Democrat in the White House or Democratic leadership, Democratic majority in the Senate or the House, you have a lot more independence at your disposal, if you will, in the process that we have here in the United States. And because of that, it can make it much more, a much lengthier, tedious process to get to a solution that gets passed by both the House and the Senate and signed into law by the president. So that is challenging. At the same time, it shows respect for really everybody. The process that we have here, the structure that we have here, and as voters, as leaders in public office, we need to recognize that, yes, it's tedious, but it's because we truly respect the rights of everybody to participate in the process. Now let's sit down and work it out and figure it out.
Right. In your afterword, you say democracy is a form of government that recognizes we all have something to contribute to the governing process, as well as a right to participate in that process. Something else about the nuts and bolts of the way our democracy is put together and the way it's functioning at the moment takes us back to the introduction co-written by Trent Lott and Tom Daschle, where they say at one point our democracy was set up with a rather elaborate system of checks and balances. And they say those checks and balances have stopped working. In fact, they have begun to work against us. What do you think they're getting at there in talking about the way checks and balances are functioning right now in our democracy?
Well, the checks and balances slow down the process, but in the context of gerrymandering, and we really do need, I think, to take seriously the importance of having congressional districts that are drawn by bipartisan commissions rather than by those who are working to protect their seat in Congress, their seat in the House, with a congressional district that is safe for them and their political party. Trent Lott and Tom Daschle also make the statement that bipartisanship is the life force that keeps our government running. And toward making that actually happen, we need to get some reforms on how congressional districts are drawn, but also the rules of the House, which are different from the rules of the Senate. We need to make sure that we're not establishing rules that make it easier for the party that's in power to steamroll over those who disagree with what they want to do. We really need to continue to work to ensure that we have balance in the process, balance that respects the rights of people all across the country, and that every side needs to be heard.
Something else that is explored that I wish we had longer to talk about, this is from the essay by Dan Glickman from Kansas, former mm-hmm. U.S. representative and now senior fellow for the Bipartisan Policy Center. He says that today, most of the incentives in our political system do not favor consensus or, God forbid, compromise. And of course, that is a really serious issue, and one I should think not easily remedied.
It's not just gerrymandering that is causing problems, but also the money that is, and the big dollar contributors to political campaigns. And we do need to figure out a way that is consistent with our First Amendment rights to express ourselves and at the same time provide the kind of balance that's needed so that there is a more fair structure in terms of elections and who gets elected. I mean, it's with independent expenditures, we and upholding the First Amendment is very, very important, but we need reform in how we finance political campaigns as well.
For sure. You also spend some time, as do at least one of your contributors, to the whole matter of media and social media. Todd Young from Indiana says at one point, the democratization of media has created a welcome proliferation of news outlets, but also has resulted in a self-sorting of news consumption, where we read coverage that confirms our own biases and pulls us further from those who do not share them. I think a lot of us are very, very well aware of that. In your afterword, in talking about social media and the way in which it sometimes compromises the well-being of our democracy, you point out something that actually has been studied and proven to be true, that in social media, lies spread more quickly and spread more broadly than truths. And that's a really, really scary thing to think about.
Do you know, if you've ever studied psychology, and I have a doctoral minor in social psychology called, it's actually called a work in depth, but because I studied consumer economics, and it is a fact that we like to have our own opinions confirmed. And so with all the choices that we have, and many people are going to social media platforms and websites that they know will confirm what they want to believe, and we really need to do, I think, a much better job of teaching information literacy in our schools, and not to promote one position over another, but to help everybody learn how to assess the credibility of information that we see posted somewhere. There was a time when we had many more local news outlets, and the professionals that were running those news outlets, you may not have always liked what they wrote, but they had a structure and a system of independence and very strict rules, as you know, on how to report a news story, to make sure there's a distinction between news reporting and opinion writing. And I am really struck by how much false information is posted on social media platforms, and by some news outlets that are now claiming to be entertaining, that their mission is entertainment rather than news reporting.
Right. And of course, it is the kind of thing that tends to attract attention. And that brings us to one other point that I wanted to be sure to make that is made repeatedly in your book, and that is the fact that political rancor also tends to attract a lot of attention. And somebody in your book quotes a study that shows that those members of Congress who are hyper-partisan are covered much, much more extensively than those who are more moderate and bipartisan in the way that they carry out their duties. And this is something said repeatedly, that in fact there is a bit more bipartisanship and cooperation going on Capitol Hill than most of us are aware of, because much of that cooperation is out of the headlines, not talked about, and maybe also not attached to sort of headline-making measures. But it's important for us to acknowledge this, and maybe this is something we can build upon.
Well, I agree with you, and I also think that for many members of Congress in the House and the Senate both, that politically they're better off if they're not talking a lot about bipartisanship and working across the aisle, because it might be more difficult for them to get reelected because they may be representing a state or a district that is very skewed in one direction or another politically. And so that is a challenge as well. But it is much more interesting, for example, to write about an automobile accident than somebody driving and obeying the speed limit and and respecting every stop sign and other driver. I mean, you're not going to get a news story covering somebody driving cautiously from their home to their workplace. But if there's an accident, it's a story.
Right.
And it's the same thing in covering politics. And that's why I think it's so important for everyone to be engaged and to be seriously engaged, looking for the truth, not for confirmation of what they want to be the truth.
Exactly. And
when we get on the scale to make sure that we're staying healthy or doing our best to stay healthy, we could rig our scale a little bit so that it makes it look like we weigh less than we do. Or if we have an issue where we need to gain weight, maybe move it up a little bit. But that doesn't really help us. The same thing is true in running our democracy. We may feel better for a little bit that somebody agrees with us, we think, and we're right. But what really matters is, are we right? Are we telling ourselves the truth?
Absolutely. I want to mention the fact that your book touches on a number of real-life examples of bipartisanship at work and certain great accomplishments in our country's history that were the result of cooperation and compromise. In just a minute or so, I'm afraid, I want to give you the chance to choose one that is one of your favorites, a great example of bipartisanship.
Well, I think that when you find that the Democrats and Republicans ultimately can agree on the federal budget for the upcoming fiscal year, that is some of the most important work that is done, obviously, in the United States Congress. And I think in terms of importance, how we spend the public's tax dollars is very important, and spending those dollars in a way that strengthen us economically and strengthen our national security, strengthen our public's health, and we oftentimes see it goes right up to the deadline, and then they come together, and I think that shows a sense of responsibility on the part of those who in the end make the compromises that are necessary to keep this country going.
Very well put. Dan Glickman from Kansas, whom we quoted a little earlier, I love the way he says at one point in his essay, "I refuse to believe that our current division is permanent or that what ails us cannot be overcome." And indeed, there is reason for hope, and we find some of those reasons outlined in this very compelling book, again titled Across the Aisle, Why Bipartisanship Works for America, published by Indiana University Press and edited by Jill Long Thompson. Jill Long Thompson, thank you so much for giving the world, for giving our country this important book, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Thank you. It's my privilege. Thank you.
Ms. Thompson wanted me to add that all proceeds from the sale of this book will be donated directly to the Bipartisan Policy Center. Monday on the morning show, Michelle Ferrari, writer, producer, and director of the Next American Experience documentary, this one titled The American Vice President, a fascinating look at the place of the vice president in our American political life. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. And for those of you who have recently visited the morning show archives on our website, the recent missing programs have been restored, thankfully. Our weather forecast is for partly sunny skies today and a high temperature of 76 degrees. But clouds overnight with a low of 62. Clouds tomorrow with a high of 71. Mostly sunny skies and very comfortable conditions for the next week. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.